Okay, so from Tanya's talk earlier, actually on Tuesday, you saw a bit how do we use hyperelliptic curves. Now the question is, we want to use them for cryptography. Are they a good choice for cryptography? That's one question we should also ask ourselves. Okay, so just to recap the notation very quickly, when you saw the discrete log earlier with Roger's talk, it was in terms of multiplicative groups. Now here we're going to be in additive groups. It's not a big difference, it's just a little bit of notation, and that everything is going to be easy. So you have a group generated by an element A, and you have an element B in that group. You want to find the discrete log of B in base A. That is, you want to find an integer lambda such that B is lambda times A. Okay, now when we look at the discrete log, which I'll note DL of B in base A, we have a few properties. These are basically the same properties as the log that you're used to, except that they're written additively, which makes them even easier to remember. You added the discrete log of B plus C in base A is the discrete log of B plus the discrete log of C modulo the order of the group. The discrete log of a multiple of B, well, it's that multiple times the discrete log of B. And finally, if you have another generator C for your group, then you can write the discrete log of B in base A as the discrete log of B in base C over the discrete log of A in base C. Right? These should all be very somewhat familiar from the usual logarithm function. Right? You've all seen that in high school, except multiplicatively. Okay, so just to recap a bit more, when we're looking at a group, at a general group, that a group that where we have no extra information, the best known attacks, you have baby step, giant step, you have spotted row, and you have spotted kangaroo, and these all run in time big O of square root of the group order, group operations. Now, you also remember that you have Pauling-Hellman, so you want your group to be, the group order to be either a prime or almost a prime. Otherwise, you can just break it down into subgroups. Okay. Now, when we look at hyperelliptic curves and a hyperelliptic curve of genus G over the field FQ, as Tanya already told you, the group order is of size Q to the G, roughly. There's an error term. That error term is under control. So it's basically Q to the G. That's the part you need to really remember. And so if we want to have a group of size n, where n was a group of for our elliptic curves, for example, then you need, well, if you fix the genus, you want to see what field size do I need to have a group of size n. Well, it's easy enough. All you need to take the log of the field size to be about 1 over g times log n. Okay, so we can do that. Now, if we look at hyperelliptic curve, the cost for the field arithmetic. Now, what happens in the field arithmetic, and Dan is not here, so you won't disagree with me too much, is that at the sizes we're looking at, things are still quadratic. The fast arithmetic can be used a bit, but it doesn't make that much of a difference. It's not linear time. It's really quadratic time, more or less. So I'm going to use O of log Q squared. And when we want to do the group operation in a hyperelliptic curve, we can use Cantor's algorithm or explicit formulas, and they're essentially big O of G squared. Okay, so if we look at this very quickly, we've reduced the field size by a factor of 1 over g, which means that we have an increase in speed for the field arithmetic of a factor of 1 over g squared. But then we have big O of g squared field operations to do instead of big O of 1. So at a quick look, from a quick glance of it, things might be more or less the same. Okay. That's sort of nice. Now can we say a bit more than that? Well, now, there are some more technical things that come in. If you want to compare with an elliptic curve over a field of 160 bits, then you can play around with your genus and choose your field size so that you have a group of 160 bits. Well, if I decide to go up to genus 5, and the reason I want to go for genus 5 right here is that I want the field size to go down to 32 bits. Now, on a computer, at least on a 32-bit processor, a 32-bit field is very nice. You get rid of most of the large integer arithmetic, which means you get a huge speed up. So if we could go to genus 5 with a 32-bit field, it would be great. Okay, so we might get some serious speed up, except that for first problem, we're using asymptotic results and assuming that they work for the small values. That's usually not such a good idea. You still want to check things out, see if they really behave as you expect for asymptotics. But even worse, we're assuming that for the divisor class group of the hyperelliptic curve of genus 5, it behaves like a generic group. And that's where we make a huge assumption that's actually completely false. Okay. So in this case, there's a different attack that comes in, what we call index calculus. The idea of index calculus, if you write it in terms of an additive group, is that we suppose that you have a set P1 up to PK, which we'll call the factor base. These are elements in the group. These are elements that you're going to choose. We'll see later how you choose them. And suppose that you also know the discrete log of each of these elements. Okay, that's another thing that we're going to see in a minute. Where does that come from? That's not completely free. And suppose you're able to write relations of this form. So a multiple of B is equal to alpha 1 times P1, a multiple of P1 plus a multiple of P2 plus, and so on up to a multiple of PK. Now, you know all the discrete logs of these guys. Remember the formulas I had for the discrete log, the properties. If you have the discrete log of a sum, it's the sum of the discrete logs. If I have the discrete log of a multiple of a point, it's the multiple of the discrete log of the point. So you just plug that in here, and you get this nice relation. Now, suppose that gamma is invertible modulo n, modulo the order of your group. If your group order is prime, that's not such a big assumption. Of course, if your group order is 2 to the n, that might be a bigger assumption, but then again, at that point, you might as well use Pauli-Kalman. So for what we're going to look at, you might as well assume that the group order is a prime, which means inverting is almost always safe. Okay, so then we divide by gamma mod n, and we find this relation, which means we can solve the discrete log of B in base A. Okay, now the question is, where do we get those discrete logs of the PJs in base A? Well, we're going to do things a little bit differently. Instead of looking at multiples of B in terms of the elements of the factor base, let's get a bunch of relations which are multiples of A in terms of the elements of the factor base. If we get enough of those, well, each one of these gives you a relation of this form. Discrete log of A in base A, we all know it's 1. So here, what we're looking at is relations of this form. These deltas we can compute from our factorization. And now the discrete logs of the PJs are our variables. So we have a set of equations which are linear equations in a bunch of variables. That sounds a lot like linear algebra, and that should. Okay, so if the system is big enough, then so if the system has full rank, then we can solve for the discrete log of the PJs, and assuming that those discrete logs exist. Now I said I choose the PJs in my group, so the discrete log does exist, and it's unique. So the solution will make sense. So I can apply the linear algebra and find and solve the system. Okay, so we still have a few things to work out. First of all, we need to choose the factor base. We need to choose our PJs in a sensible way. Right? It's easy for me to say you choose P1 up to PK and say nothing else, and then you don't have any idea how to do it. You also need to find what we call smooth relations. So relations that factor over the factor base, that I can write in terms of the factor base. And finally, I need to see how to solve the linear equation. Okay, the first two, well, choosing a factor base, if we were looking at the number field sieve for a finite field, we would be looking at prime integers. Well, here, we're looking in the group of divisors. So we might as well look at prime divisors. That's reasonable enough. To see if a relation is smooth or not, what we need to do is we need to factor it. We need to look at the group element and try to factor it in terms of the factor base. Now, for the linear algebra, if you use classical methods like Gaussian elimination, well, you have a system of k variables and k equations. Solving that is basically big O of k cubed. It's a bit expensive. Now, the thing is, the relations that we find in index calculus are not of, a lot of the coefficients will be zero. In fact, almost all the coefficients will be zeros in the equation. You will have a small proportion of the coefficients which will be non-zero. That proportion is the omega here, and in that case, you can solve the discrete log. You can solve the linear system in big O of omega k squared. Okay, if k is tiny, if omega is tiny, then that goes well. That you've saved essentially a factor of k. That's good. That's done with either Lanczos algorithm or Wiedemann's algorithm. The two versions of two slightly different algorithms, they have essentially the same, asymptotic running time. There's tiny differences in when you actually implement it. Which one do you want to choose, and so on, depends on your system, depends on the computer you're using, and so on. Okay, now I've shown it to you in one way. That is, we need to solve all the discrete logs of the PJs, and then find the discrete log of B from that. Well, you can do things a little bit differently. What if I decide to look at, instead of looking at multiples of A or multiples of B, what if I look at the divisor class 0? Now, I said divisor class. That means I have more than one divisor in that class. I might try to pick another divisor, a different divisor from 0 in the divisor class of 0, and see if I can factor that divisor. If I can do that, then I get a factorization of the sum of the PJs, which add up to 0. Okay. Well, in that case, if you have enough of those, then these relations basically link the PJs together. So, for example, in the first case, you might be able to write P1 in terms of P2 up to PK. Then the next relation might give you P2 in terms of P3 up to PK, and so on. So if you have enough of those relations, eventually you can write sort of cancel out all the PJs. And that can simplify things a little bit, assuming you can do that quickly, which will turn out to be a little bit more complicated. The other solution is, well, instead of completely getting rid of the multiples of A and multiples of B, what if we just take both of them at once? We write everything in terms of a multiple of A plus a multiple of B, try to factor that. Well, it's very similar to what we did at first, except that in that case, we're going to look for a solution that's slightly different. We're going to look through a bunch of these equations, try to find a linear combination of those equations so that these terms all disappear, so that we're left only with a sum with a multiple of A plus a multiple of B. Well, if I have a multiple of A equal to 0 plus a multiple of B equal to 0, I'm pretty much done. So, and the idea here will be essentially to, again, build a matrix from these things and find a non-zero element in the kernel of that matrix. That's where Wiedemann's algorithm works best. Okay. So, let's see. We have a random linear combination of A and B, which we can write as a sum over PJ. Well, you take all those delta ij, take them into a matrix, and now the thing is, if I have more than k plus 1 of these relations, then the matrix has more equations than variables. You all remember from first year linear algebra that a system with more equations than variable must have a non-zero element in its kernel. That's what we're going to look for. So, and we need really just one extra equation, and we have enough. Okay. So, which means we'll get a linear combination of this form equal to 0 mod n. Okay. So we have these guys, so these sums of gamma I delta ij, which are equal to 0 for every j, right? The element in the kernel of the matrix. Now, I can multiply everything by each term by pj and sum over all the primes, and I still get 0. I get 0 times p1 plus 0 times p2 plus 0 times p3 and so on. Better be 0. Okay? Now let's switch the order of summation. We add the sum of the over I of the gamma I's times the sum of the j delta ij pj. Now this should look a little bit familiar. What are those? Those were our factorization of alpha I A plus beta I B. Okay, so we substitute those back in, get the A's together, the B's together, and, well, just to simplify things, let's rewrite this as alpha and this as beta. Now we have alpha times A plus beta times B. Okay, and, so there was another slide there. And now, assuming that I can divide by beta, well, again, it's assuming that the beta is invertible mod n, which, if n is a prime, is relatively easy, then we can solve for b. Okay. Now, the advantage of this is that you need exactly k plus 1 relations. Remember, when we're looking for the discrete logs of the PJs, I said we need a matrix of full rank. In general, a matrix of full rank has more than k equations. It's a little bit hard to say exactly when will the matrix have full rank. Here, we know exactly k plus 1 relation will be enough. That's nice to have some safety like that. Which means that the system is just the size you need, which makes things a little bit faster for the linear algebra. The more equations you have, the longer the linear solving the system will be. And now, one tricky thing is that the PJs don't actually have to be multiples of A. They could be in a bigger group. We basically canceled them out. We didn't actually solve the discrete log of P1 in terms of A. So it might not exist. We don't care. We don't have any P1s at the end. Okay, well, the only disadvantage here is that we haven't found the PJs. Which means that if I solve the discrete log problem for one B, and I want to solve for another B, for B2, well, the equations that I had are no use anymore. They just sums, it's just a B in terms of A. It doesn't give me anything about the PJs. So I have to restart the linear algebra again for every B I want to solve. Okay, so if you want to solve only one discrete log in your group, that's a good solution. If you want to solve a lot of them, then you want to solve for the discrete logs of the PJs first. And then whenever someone comes up with a different element for which you need the discrete log, well, you just need one smooth relation. Okay. So where do we choose the PJs? Okay, well, as I said, we're going to look at prime divisors. Okay, what's a prime divisor? Tanya hinted at it a little bit. Actually, she pretty much defined it. But I'm going to do it again. So a prime divisor, well, the idea, and here, just to confuse you, the Frobenius is now called sigma. It's not FQ or... Well, that's, Renier is not very happy, but that's how I'm writing it here. Okay, good. At least one person is happy. All right, so what do we do? Well, what's the most simple form of a divisor? Of a divisor of degree zero? It's a point minus the point at infinity. And that point, P, doesn't have to be over FQ. It can be over any extension of FQ. Okay, but we want to factor a divisor which is defined over FQ, that is, which is fixed under the Frobenius. So we might as well choose our prime divisors to be fixed under the Frobenius as well. So what you do is you take your P and you take all its images under the Frobenius, right? Don't loop twice, just loop once. Once you get P again, you stop and you're done. Now you take all those, and I did make a mistake. This should be to I minus one. Okay. Well, I have too many divisors on one. The points don't add up to zero. That's not too good. Okay. So suppose this was I minus one. Then we would have a divisor which is fixed under the Frobenius. If you apply the Frobenius to that sum, you get the same thing. You just shifted that by one. And then the last one came back to P. So it's fixed under the Frobenius. And if you look at any factor of that divisor, if you break it down into two divisors of degree zero, the parts won't be fixed under the Frobenius. You will miss some of the points when you try to rotate. So this is the most basic choice, the most basic blood that we can choose that's fixed under the Frobenius. Those will be our prime divisors. Okay, and one nice thing is that if I look at a semi-reduced divisor, or if I look at a divisor which doesn't have where you never see a point and the involution of that point, then that, as long as you don't have that problem, then the divisor factors uniquely in terms of this, as a sum of prime divisor, as a positive sum of prime divisors. Okay, that, now you have to be careful. If I say here the divisor, not the class of the divisor. You have more than one choice in the class of divisors. That's why we were able to say, let's look at divisors in the class 0, and let's find different factorization of those. Well, you choose one divisor in the class 0, and you try to factor it. Another one, and you try to factor it, and so on. Okay. Now, if you look at, okay, so if you try to think in terms of factorization, it's a little bit easier in the ideal class group. For one thing, things are multiplicative. So it's in the sense that you're used to factor. So we have, now a prime ideal, in this case, is essentially an ideal that you can never write as a product of two ideals of FQ that are other than one and the ideal itself. Right, just as you had prime integers, you have prime ideals, and it's essentially the same definition. Okay, now if I look at my prime ideal, I can write it in this form: u of x y minus v of x, and in that case, u of x is an irreducible monic polynomial. And then v of x, to make it unique, you just take the degree of V to be less than the degree of U. And this thing will be unique. If we want to look back in terms, okay, this is where notation is a little nasty. Now, if we look at it, an ideal U of X, Y minus V of X, forget this, the equation right above it, just look at this one. So we have a reduced ideal, or a semi-reduced ideal. Now, I want to factor it. What do I do? Well, I take U, and I factor U. I get a product of UI. Well, the factorization of this ideal is the product of the ideals defined by UI, Y minus VI, where VI is simply V mod UI. So it's easy. Okay, since we have a factor base where we have reduced, where we have prime ideals, we need to sort of define a size for the ideals. The size of an ideal, of a prime ideal, will be the degree of U of X. Okay, easy enough. That's basically the number of points other than the point at infinity in the divisor. Okay, and now we look at a factor base. The factor base B, or script B, will be all the ideals of, all the prime ideals of size at most capital B, for some bound capital B. Okay, so, and now that I've defined a prime ideal, then I will say that an ideal is B smooth if all its prime factors are of degree at most B. Okay, not too bad. Now, the only thing is that we need to choose that value of B. We have a lot of choice. I could say B is 1, B is 29, B is 264. What do I choose for capital B? Well, that's where things are a little fun. And just to make the notation a little bit easier, the order of the factor base, the number of prime divisors of size less or equal to capital B, are denoted as KB, right, so that I don't have to carry too many things around. Okay, now we need to look into probabilities a little bit. We have, so we want to know, we have these smooth divisors. What's the probability that we get, we have these prime divisors. What's the probability that we get a B smooth divisor? Well, okay, let's call that probability PB. There's a bit of, there's quite a bit of arguments in there into knowing what PB will be, but assume that you have it now. What can we say? Well, I need K, how many of the, of the smooth relations do I need? Suppose that you're using the, you're looking for a non-zero element in the kernel of a matrix. You need KB plus one. Okay, well, let's make that big O of K, of KB at some point. But for now, it's going to be KB plus one. Okay. Okay. Now I'm just defining a random variable, which will say that XI is going to be the, will be one if the I divisor that I look at is smooth, is B smooth, and zero otherwise. And now, what I want is, I want to look at the sum from one to j of these xi, right? Let's call that yj. And what I want is, I want an idea of how does yj behave. Okay, in a way, you want to go on until the sum of the xi's is equal to kb plus 1. Right. In this case, you can make things a little bit easier. It doesn't change much in terms of probabilities. It's just the equations are a little bit nicer. And we're just going to look at the distribution of yj. Well, the expected value of yj, you have j divide, you're looking at j divisors, which may or may not be smooth. Each one with probability pb. So the expected value here is J times PB. Easy enough. And the variance here, well, it's a Bernoulli distribution. So it's J times PB times 1 minus PB. Okay, assuming that PB is small, even actually for that, here you don't even need to assume that. Well, if PB is small, then this is basically 1, which means this is essentially J times PB. Now that means that the standard deviation is roughly J times, square root of J times PB. And in fact, it's always less than that. Okay, so that gives us a bound on the standard deviation. Now, if you all remember your probabilities a little bit, you should all remember Chebyshev's inequality. What does that say again? Well, I want, Chebyshev's inequality gives me a bound on the probability that the difference between yj and its expected value is bigger than something. Right? The probability that the difference between yj and its expected value is bigger or equal to c times the standard deviation is at most 1 over c squared. In fact, it's usually a lot less than that. But that's a bound that's always true. Well, okay, we had a standard deviation on the last page that was roughly the square root of the expected value. Now, we have an expected value, okay, we will want the expected value to be about KB. So we need to run it until we have roughly KB relations. And the error here is actually going to be pretty small. So if you look at things a little bit, and you can very quickly say, well, okay, let's overshoot a little bit. Let's see, if I overshoot by, here I say, by about 2%, then assuming that K is big enough, here it's, I said, bigger than 100,000, that's actually pretty small. For discrete logs. when you're talking about discrete logs, K tends to be very, very big. So this is a small condition. So if I overshoot by 2% in this case, from what the expected value for the time where the expected value would be KB, then 99.99% of the time, I will have enough relations. And it goes the other way around. If I stop 2% early, 99.99% of the chance, I won't have enough relations. Okay, so we're pretty safe. We know in what range of time things will work out. Good. Okay, and as I said here, in a sense, this is much better than for parted row. Parted row, the standard deviation for parted row is quite big. The standard deviation for parted row is about one half of the expected value. Here, it's a tiny, tiny proportion of the expected value. So we're going to stay very close to the expected value. Okay, now if you look at the, so let's bring everything together. So we have a fighter base of size, the fighter base is bounded at size capital B. The fighter base has order KB, and smooth divisors come up with probability PB. So as we said, you need to look at basically KB over PB smooth divisor to find KB smooth divisors. Okay, and now what's the cost here? Well, the cost for doing things here, we're going to do things with a random walk. We're going to walk around in the group. And at each divisor we see, we're going to try to factor it. Okay, in that case, well, the group operation is of that size, and the factorization to check whether it factors and to factor it if it does is roughly that cost. Okay, so these are nasty terms which we'll ignore in a minute. The log Q terms are going to vanish, the factors of G are going to vanish, we're going to worry about the powers of Q. But let's keep them for a few more seconds. Now, solving the linear algebra problem. Well, if we do things, if we're looking at reduced divisors, there's at most G prime divisors in the factorization. Right? Worst case scenario, you have G prime divisors over FQ. Defined over FQ, G linear prime divisors. Well, most of the time, some of them will be bunched together. So big O of G is the number of non-zero coefficients in that relation. So the omega that you have will be G. Now you have KB squared because you have KB variables, and these are all operations mod N. Which means that, and remember, n is big O of g squared log q. Sorry, n is g log q, and I said that things at our sizes are still quadratic. Dan is in the room, but he's not looking at me, so I'm still safe. And now we have, okay, so now if we forget about the log terms and the g and the factors of g, what we're left with is basically KB over PB plus, so big O of KB over PB plus big O of KB squared. And we want to minimize that. Well, okay, we don't have the constants here. So it's a little bit hard to really minimize that. What we do in that case is we're going to choose KB and PB so that these two sizes, these two things are roughly the same asymptotic form. Right? In a sense, the bigger, think of it in this way. The bigger my fighter base, the bigger KB will be. But when my fighter base increases, the chance that the divisor be smooth is higher. So PB is going to increase, which means that as my factor base increases, this term increases, and this one, well, it's actually going to decrease, but it's a little bit harder to see that. Okay. So if we do that, and if we plug in a few of the results, which I'm not going to show here, the first version of index calculus for hyperelliptic curves was by Adleman, Demare, and Wang, and what they did is they looked at divisors in the class 0. Right? So they tried to find relations between the PJs. Now, doing that, they ended up with a running time of the form. Did we use that notation before? Not yet, right? Log one half of and blah blah blah. Okay. This means so we have ln of C alpha, I don't know if I'm writing it that way, is really that exponential of which word A alpha log n to the c log n to the 1 minus c. So that means we have roughly exponential of 4 times the square root of the log of the group order. Okay, but that's assuming that the log of the field size is small enough compared to the genus. That is, if you look at the curve, it has quite high genus compared to the field size. And now, if we use the kernel approach, that was the idea introduced by Enger and Gaudry, and doing the heuristics with a little bit more work, well, there was some time between the two papers, so heuristics improved a bit in the meantime. It's possible to reduce the cost to L of one half, roughly something that goes towards square root 2. Right? It's a little bit bigger than square root 2, but roughly square root 2. Okay, one of the big differences between these two, it comes from the fact that you're trying to solve an element in the kernel of the matrix instead of finding links between the PJs. Finding links between the PJs, you cannot use the sparse linear algebra algorithms. So the cost of the linear algebra is actually bigger than 2, than k squared. So that, which made a big difference in going from 4 to roughly square root 2. Okay. Now, I mentioned it a little bit, that we do random walks if we want to find linear combinations of A and B that are smooth. What if we're looking at smooth divisors in the class 0? It's a little bit difficult to do a random walk in the class 0. You add two elements in the class 0 and they reduce to 0. You add two elements in the class 0, you're back to 0 again. That's not the right solution. Okay, so we're going to do things differently. Well, if I want a divisor in the class 0, it has to be a principal ideal. Now, a principal ideal is generated by one polynomial, by a single polynomial in x and y. And since we're modulo the equation of the curve, you might as well make it a polynomial of the form a of x times y minus b of x. Okay, so one solution is to choose a random a and a random b and look at those polynomials. But now, when I define the prime ideals, I define them as from the factorization of U of X. Well, this is U of X and a multiple of Y minus V of X. I'm missing a U of X. Okay, so let's see, can we do a little bit, can we play around a little bit to get a good one, a good choice? Well, we're really working in this ring here. F of XY modulo the equation of the curve, y squared minus h of plus h of x y minus f of x. I'm here I'm writing the generic form of the hyperelliptic curve. Okay, well, this ideal here is all the multiples of a of x y minus b of x. So it also contains this divisor here. It also contains that polynomial here. Okay. And to see that, well, we're modulo the equation y squared minus plus h of x y minus f of x. So this is really zero in that ring. Well, if we have zero in the ring, it better be in every ideal. Okay. So we look at this equation and we rewrite things. We get the a of x and y together and we get a of x, y squared and so on. And now a of x, y minus b of x, then r of x, y must be zero modulo this polynomial. Okay, so you have this, you plug in the a of x. And now every time I see a of x, y, I can replace it by b of x. And it's still in the same ideal. Well, now, the way I wrote the polynomial here, every time I have a y, I also have an a of x. So I get rid of all the y's. I'm left with the polynomial in x only. Well, that's going to be my u of x. Okay, and then when you want to find the v of x, well, you just look at this equation, and you want to turn that into y minus v, so you need to divide by a mod u of x. Okay, so you choose a random a and b, and things work out okay as long as your u is co-prime with a, which if you choose a and b, co-prime at the beginning is going to work out okay. Okay, the second case and the last one, so I'm going to finish on time, Tanya, good news, is what about our random walk when we're looking at a non-zero element in the kernel? Well, in that case, we could do the same kind of random walk as we did with Pollard Row, right? With Pollard Row, you set up a random walk and you do your random walk until you get back to a divisor that you've seen before. Or at least until you get back one of the few divisors that you record. Well, here, we don't really care about going back to a divisor we've seen before. We want to run faster than Pollard Row. Pollard Row, the runtime of Pollard Row is basically how long does it take to close the loop. Well, if we don't really need to close the loop here, we're doing things differently. We want to run faster than Pollard Row, so we don't actually want to close the loop. Okay, well, that means, do we really care that if I go to the same divisor twice, does it really matter if the next step goes to the same place? For Pollard Row, it does. In Pollard Row, when you close your loop, so you walk around, you close your loop. Now, usually in Pollard Row, you don't save all the divisors. You save only the distinguished points, which may be here and here, for example. Well, you need to do the same walk until you get to that point. So the walk has to be fixed from the point you're at, from the representation of your point. Well, when we're doing index calculus, we don't really care about closing a loop. So we don't really care about what happens if we come when we close a loop like that. Well, we might go in a different direction. We don't care. It's not a question of closing loops. It's a question of smooth divisors. So the next step of the random walk can be completely independent from the representation. It can just be add a divisor from a set of random from a fixed set of randomly chosen divisors at the beginning. Okay. Now, which is what I've written there. And that concludes things for this morning. Well, not for this morning, for this hour. Okay, so I think we come back at 15:15.